All right, happy Friday, and we're glad you made it. Write down our toll-free telephone number. You want to be a part of this extravaganza. You know, I don't spend a lot of time on this program dealing with, well, the issues, the things that are written, said about me, which is kind of every single day, someplace, somewhere. And, you know, for years, Sweet Baby James would print out a pile of crap that people wrote about me. And I'd be like, I just don't want to read it. I don't care. Whatever switch may have long existed. It's, you know, I'm 30 years in radio now. I'm 23 years in Fox. And everything, every lie that could be written or said about me, every criticism that could be given, sometimes they actually get it right. And I look at myself, I'm thoughtful enough to just face the truth. And, you know, I can take criticism if it's offered in the right way. And even if it's offered in the wrong way, somebody can say something and I can say, all right, well, that's true. And I can be a better person. That's fine. But there just are so many moments now that it happens. And I don't like to spend a lot of time on it, but it just has to be dealt with. You know, the media in this country, they didn't do their job. We have John Solomon the next hour. John Solomon exposes how the Mueller report repeatedly got wrong on purpose. They wanted to create a false perception narrative, and they literally knew the truth, and they spun it in a way, the worst way possible, to make Donald Trump look bad and leave insinuations that they know are not true. I mean, we saw that in that press conference with Robert Mueller last week. And for a few hours, you know, after he said, well, it wasn't a question, we didn't have the ability to consider indicting a sitting president because of DOJ policy and constitutional issues involving whether you can or cannot indict a sitting president. That was never a factor by his own words. He was just going to present the facts. The special counsel law being very different from the old independent counsel statute, which people like Jerry Nadler wanted changed desperately after the Clinton impeachment. Remember, Ken Starr listed 11 specific felonies that were committed by then President Bill Clinton. 11. I mean, and they're all true. I mean, he lost his law license. He was impeached. And he also paid out nearly $1 million to Paula Jones in that particular case. But he outright lied under oath repeatedly. There are people we now know going to jail as a result of the Mueller investigation over such issues, but not Bill Clinton. And nobody wanted to indict him after he left. And, you know, was it the right thing to do? Not the right thing. I'll let, you know, history can decide that. I don't feel like looking back. But we have a media that has literally done the same thing. They have not done their job. They have willingly taken on the role of cheerleaders, the role of press departments for all things anti-Trump, you know, building in into a crescendo of a mass rage psychosis syndrome against Trump and all things Trump. And it's every second of every minute of every hour. They can't help themselves. You know, they had a few hours last week where they thought, oh, it's alive again. Thank you. It's been so horrible since the Mueller report came out. And no, for the fourth time, it's been determined Trump did not collude with Russia or conspire with Russia to impact the 2016 elections. Everyone forgets that Hillary cheated Bernie in the primary, stole that from him. Bernie never had a shot. Donna Brazile chronicles the call when she filled in for Debbie Wasserman Schultz after that scandal and had to tell Bernie, yeah, it's all true. You got screwed. And it looked like they conspired to do it. And supposedly these rules have changed. I don't think enough. I would say always whoever the establishment backs has a decisive advantage within the Democratic Party ranks. And I don't think that's going to go away. But you know, it's like they missed the biggest abuse of power scandal in their lifetime. And so Nancy Pelosi, well, talks about this issue. I want the president in jail. Now, on the other hand, she has behind the scenes and been very reluctant publicly to say anything about the issue of impeaching Trump, because I think Nancy Pelosi, understands she really doesn't have much power anymore. You know, I say she's speaker in name only because if Ocasio-Cortez or this group of freshman congressmen and women want her out, even though they were very sneaky, unlike Boehner, they can't call for a new vote to remove Pelosi. Well, if they really wanted to, they could just change the rules if there's enough of them and she could be out that way. But Pelosi lives in a state of fear. The president got mad at the president because he called her Nervous Nancy. And, it, you know, for her, you know, here's the president in Normandy and Nancy Pelosi, you know, takes off on the president and attacks him and hopes that the president goes to prison. I think while the president was meeting with the French president at the time, Macron. And so she goes out there. Then, you know, he even said, well, fine. You know, usually when the president is abroad, you know, politics ends at the water's edge. But it's just a bunch of crap because we also know that a bunch of Obama cabinet people, John Kerry among them, apparently, have been back channeling with the mullahs of Iran and other enemies of the country. We'll defeat this guy. We'll get rid of him and things will be better. We'll drop more cash on your tarmac. We'll try and bribe you in the future. Meanwhile, Trump's strategy with Iran is working because the economy is in a tailspin and the mullahs in Iran have already spent most of the money, yeah, that we gave them on terror activities and fighting proxy wars and certainly not sharing it with the people of Iran. And their young population is as restless as ever. And, you know, hopefully one day we hope that, you know, the people in Iran can overthrow the mullahs and maybe a new day can dawn for the people of Iran. We'll see. All right, but just back to the Nancy Pelosi thing. So the media is out there. They're just dumb. They're stupid. They're lazy. They literally believe their own conspiracy theories, their own hoaxes, their own lies, to the point where I made a comment that it was pretty despicable what, you know, Nancy Pelosi said, meaning, well, let's put him in prison. Well, I said, well, you know, the problem here is that's the stuff of a banana republic. I did say that. And so they write it up. Oh, but what about Hannity? What about all these people that said lock her up about Hillary Clinton? So finally today, I got a call from one of the people. It's all over the media, you know, and Sweet Baby James says, are you aware that they're saying this about you? I said, no, what? And then he tells me, I said, well, there's a big difference. Anyway, so I got a call. I said, all right, I'm going to text you over a statement. At least they were decent enough at the Hill to give me a heads up. And they actually called me, which, you know, that's rare. They, rarely do I get calls. You know, this Michael Wolff guy literally makes things up out of whole cloth. When he wrote his first book, Fire and Fury, I literally confronted him at the next time I saw him. And I said, what you wrote about me is a complete lie. It's not true. And you never called me to ask me. I said, you know, what is that? And he, you know, literally was scared. You know, you could see he just couldn't handle the confrontation. And, you know, it was at one of these stupid award ceremonies that I was forced to go to. And so I decided to give them an answer. I said, well, as per usual, the lazy and abusively biased media mob are lying to their ever-shrinking audiences yet again. And, you know, ever since the Mueller report, I mean, fake news, CNN, they can't get a million people to watch them. They can't even, I mean, 700,000, 400,000. I mean, the numbers are so drastically low. It's, if I was them, I'd be shocked. I mean, and they don't understand that what they've done is by lying to their audience, and the same with conspiracy TV, MSNBC, same phenomenon. Well, because they built up false hope. They overpromised. They underdelivered. What they told their audience was coming was never going to come. You know, for a long time, this ensemble team that we've built here that has been telling you this entirely different story happened, and this abuse of power was real, and Hillary's investigation really was rigged, and she really did commit crime. We've been right. And we're going to be proven more right in the days, weeks, and months ahead. So I wrote the statement. I said, as per usual, the lazy and abusively biased media mob are lying to their ever-shrinking audiences yet again. And I said, Donald Trump committed no crime. So for Nancy Pelosi, lock him up is not the same as Hillary, who did commit crimes. And I said, in spite of the bizarre conspiracy theories that have been told daily now for over 2 years. And I went a little bit further. I said, the evidence in Hillary's case is overwhelming and incontrovertible. Hillary Clinton committed multiple felonies by putting classified and top secret information on a private server stored in a bathroom closet. And then I said, read the law, 18 U.S.C. 793, the Espionage Act. I've read it enough on this program. That was her underlying crime, because even James Comey admitted top secret classified information was on that private server. That is illegal. Those are all felonies. Every single instance is a separate felony. So that's her underlying crime. Then when Clinton deleted the 33,000 subpoenaed emails, had her hard drive acid washed with bleach bit, had an aide bust up the BlackBerries and iPhones with hammers, and then remove the SIM cards, well, that would be the intent. Intent is necessary for the charge of obstruction of justice. Well, there was no underlying crime of collusion, conspiracy to impact the election with Russia, no underlying crime. And Donald Trump saying, maybe I should fire Robert Mueller, or maybe I should fire this one, or Jeff Sessions isn't doing his job, is not obstructing when the president was rightfully the whole time pleading his innocence. You know, if you're innocent, act like it. Well, that's what innocent people do. They scream they're innocent. Anyway, Hillary did all of that. And then she obstructed justice with a clear intention of destroying the evidence of the underlying crime, and in the process committing the felonies of obstruction of justice in each case. And well, it's just, you know, frustrating to me that the media, they don't even know the story. They've been too lazy and locked into their own lying conspiracies. And I went further and I said, the crowds that are chanting, lock her up, are clearly referring to the crime she committed, or maybe they could be referring to the pay-for-play scheme where she grants Putin's thugs in America that wanted a foothold in the uranium industry. We know because we had an FBI spy within Putin's ring who was chronicling bribery and extortion and kickbacks and money laundering. William Campbell was the spy. And then, of course, well, she signed off on 20% of America's uranium going to the hostile regime of Russia. Her husband is getting paid twice his normal fees, looking to meet with Russian nuclear regulators, but instead met with Putin himself. And then the people involved in the money deal for Uranium One, well, the people that paid the double Clinton fee for the speech. And then $145 million from those same players end up in the Clinton Foundation. They could have been talking about that. In other words, Nancy Pelosi only wants to put a political opponent in jail who committed no crime that Nadler, the cowardly Schiff, or she could ever name, or Maxine Waters could ever name, and that would make us no better than any of the world's dictatorships. And then I said, no wonder why the Pew Research came out this week with poll numbers on the fake news in this country. The media mob is earning the public's distrust every single day. And that's the kind of crap I deal with every day. And that, by the way, I don't really care. Whatever switch I'm supposed to have that cares doesn't care. But that's who they are. 68% of Americans said this week, fake news and information impacts all of their confidence in government institutions. They now have figured out Donald Trump has successfully branded them for the liars they are. And that's forever tattooed into their brains. If you read CNN, you see fake news. CNBC, fake news. That's what people see. This is just the latest example. But they didn't even have the background knowledge because they believed their own lies. I mean, they can almost plead guilty by reason of insanity or laziness or political bias. You make your choice. Oh, Linda's going to love this one. I bet you didn't read this news yet. Did you hear about what happened? Bruce Orr was once the fourth highest ranking member inside the Justice Department. That Bruce Orr, right? The one that's married to Nellie Orr. Nellie Orr,
that's the one,
was digging up Russian dirt being paid for by Fusion GPS against Hillary. Turns out that the New York Times suggesting it is Russian disinformation from the beginning. Well, it turns out that Russiagate co-conspirator Mr. Orr actually received performance bonuses from the Department of Justice while he was busy, you know, trying to funnel Christopher Steele's information. By the way, Steele was feeding him information for Robert Mueller, which needs to be answered also. But the phony Steele dossier to the FBI. Then he was exposed and demoted for his efforts. And guess what? They actually still gave him a pay raise. Judicial Watch got the document showing that, yeah, the Bruce Orr got a larger bonus during the Russiagate investigation than he did the previous year, and even got a raise after he was demoted. I did a 28 grand bonus in November 2016, shortly after the first FISA was granted against the Trump campaign and Carter Page. And then he got a $2,600 pay increase. All right, 25 till the top of the hour, 800-941-SEAN. You want to be a part of the program? Yeah, so Bruce Orr got a $28,000 bonus in November 2016. That's unbelievable. And then he gets a pay increase. That's after he's demoted. You know, he's demoted a number of times. Wow. How do you explain that away?
Oh, I know how we explain it.
How?
It's called money laundering.
Money laundering?
It's called, I need you to do me a favor, so I'm going to give you a little something, something.
And something, something.
And I'm going to call it something, something, but we all know what it really is.
In other words, they're saying, hey, play ball.
Hey, ball, and we'll give you a signing bonus.
Oh, by the way, these weak Republicans, I'll get to this in a second. Donald Trump doesn't want a trade war. Let me help them out. Donald Trump wants Mexico to do their job. And if Mexico doesn't believe that the president's serious about saying, we're going to tariff you if you keep letting these people from Central America walk right from your country into my country, if they don't believe it's real, they're not going to do anything. Well, now Mexico believes the president in spite of weak Republicans. We'll get to that in a second. All right. Now, I'm being told that we have a great caller from New Orleans by the name of Bryce. And apparently Bryce is 12 years old. And Bryce, how are you? Glad you called, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm actually 11, sir.
You're 11. Okay. What grade are you in?
I am going into sixth grade after this summer, sir.
You're going into sixth grade? Okay. Now, do you like school?
Can't say I like it the most, but it's all right.
What would you rather do besides school?
Probably go ride my bike or play football.
You like football, huh? Do you play organized football or you just play with your buddies?
I play organized.
And what position you play?
Wide receiver.
Wow, I bet you're fast then. You're pretty quick?
Yes, sir.
Can you catch like Odell Beckham?
Not yet.
You ever try a one-handed catch like he can do? It's pretty amazing when he does it, right?
I know. I actually think I might get to meet him this summer because of my uncle.
Oh, really? Your uncle knows Odell. I don't know why the Giants got rid of him. That was kind of dumb. But anyway, how does your uncle know Mr. Beckham?
He has a friend who is training him right now out in California.
Yeah. Now, have you thought about what you want to do with your life at all? Which, by the way, it would be normal if you haven't. But is there anything that you're interested in that you'd want to do when you get older, when you get big?
I would like to either be a lawyer or be an NFL player.
Okay. Well, if you want to be... Or be a what?
Or an architect.
An NFL player, lawyer, or an architect. Okay. Now, the NFL player, you got to... It was a really great ad that I saw that the NCAA put out about sports and college sports. I think, if I remember the numbers correctly, and... Oh, I think it was... Rice that did it. What's his name? Football player Rice. It escapes me. Yeah, Jerry. I think it was Jerry Rice that did it. You're right. And anyway, so he does this ad. There are 480,000 college athletes in America, which is a lot of athletes. I mean, they have all different sports. Football, obviously, is usually the biggest attended sport for most big schools. Then you have basketball, baseball, football, tennis, volleyball. They got all sorts of great sports. And all these kids work hard to get there. But of those 480,000 college players, how many do you think ever make it to the pros? Take a guess.
At least probably 50 a year.
50, only 50 total?
Total.
Well, it's about 470,000 will never make it to the pros. So it's a very small percentage. And so if you want to be in the NFL, that's I love big dreams, but school is probably your good backup plan, right? Whether you like it or not. Yeah.
Right.
You know, I tell my kids that this is their job. My kids both play sports, but I said, look, you got a job. Your job right now is to get the best grades you can and use your best efforts. If you don't get straight A's, okay. But if you're capable of getting an A and you get a C, I'm going to be pissed off. If you don't do your work, you know, there are certain rules that dad has. I think you should follow the golden rule, love God and everybody you meet as yourself. The second rule is never go near any drugs, period. The third rule is I know kids at some point are going to drink beer or whatever. Okay, don't be the dumb kid that's throwing up in the bushes or doing shots or drinking out of a punch bowl. We have no idea what people put in it. And the fourth rule is I won't talk about. And then the fifth rule is do your jobs. And if you play a sport, you play to the best of your ability, best effort, best attitude. And if you're studying, you study your hardest and you do the work that you're supposed to do. You think those are fair rules?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, what rules do your parents give you?
Same exact ones.
The same exact ones.
You sound a lot like my grandfather, I can say.
I don't even want to ask how old your grandfather is because I'm probably his age. So what's on your mind? You called the radio talk show. It's not usual, you know, that a 12-year-old calls talk radio.
Well, I heard y'all yesterday when I was coming home from my grandfather because I went to work with him and I'm at work with him right now. Came home with him and I heard y'all talking about the Normandy landing since yesterday was the 75th anniversary. And I have two veterans in my family, and I have one who is still alive and is a friend.
Mm-hmm. And how can I ask how old your granddad is?
My grandfather?
Yeah.
58.
I'm sorry, 68?
No, 58.
Yeah, I was right. I'm 57. All right, so your grandfather's 58. That means he likely did not serve in any war, right? But maybe his father did, because my father served 4 years in the Pacific after Pearl Harbor.
Well, salute to his service, but my grandfather's grandfather actually did serve two tours in Saipan.
Oh, wow. All right, and so you have other family members that have served in the military. You know, being in the military is pretty tough.
Yes, sir.
What do you know about D-Day? Because I don't think we teach kids in school enough about the heroes that literally saved the continent and how many people lost their lives that day. What do you know about it?
Well, there's not exactly an exact body count, but from my information, from all the books I've read, there was 4,086 at least soldiers that lost their lives. This had been planned for about 1 or 2 years before. They had to set up a whole dummy army to fool Hitler. Hitler had an Atlantic wall. No one was prepared for what was going to happen. It was stormy, but one guy gave President Roosevelt the go-ahead because it was going to be perfect the next morning. It was going to be foggy. It would be perfect conditions. The Germans always knew that they would be coming, but they did not know where.
And you knew about they set up a fake staging area, and General Patton was in that. You understand that?
Yes, that's what I said, the dummy army.
That was really, that detail is really good. Now, did you learn that in school, or did your grandfather teach you, or how did you learn that?
I have watched YouTube videos and read books.
Wow, like you read history books?
Yes, sir.
And you know, because I don't think, look, I know with my kids' schools, and it used to frustrate the living daylights out of me, but, you know, they don't learn enough to me, by my liking, of American history. Have you taken a lot of American history, or did they teach you other history?
Morally, right now, since we don't right now, because I'm still in fifth grade. I don't know about next year, but they're not teaching us right now about any of the wars apart from the Revolutionary.
Right.
That's the only war they've really gone and told us about. They haven't gone into detail or anything. but they've just taught us about the reasonings and everything that has happened and all the battles.
You know, there are some great movies I think you could watch, and I'll let you, you know, I let my kids watch movies because I think they need to understand there is a very, there are good people in life and there are really bad people in life. Hitler was an evil, you know, evil human being. Stalin, evil. Pol Pot, killing fields, that's evil. I don't know what you know about that. And the attack on Pearl Harbor was evil. 9/11 was evil. So I like my kids to see that. But Saving Private Ryan, did you ever watch that movie?
I have been wanting to see that movie for so long. I keep on asking my grandfather, but he can't find it.
We watched
The Longest Day yesterday.
Oh, really? There are other great movies, too. But, you know, and there actually is the movie Pearl Harbor, which came out as well. And I think that's worthwhile watching. Well, you're an amazing young man. And, you know, the only thing I'd say is I'd encourage you to always, you know, do what you want to do and always make your own decisions. I think there's a lot of pressure on kids these days, you know, to kind of always go along with the crowd. And at the end of the day, you're going to make mistakes. And as I say to my kids, I'm like, all right, you're making a mistake, but now the next time it's a choice. And so you're going to make choices in your life that will impact your life. And if you make good choices, you're going to have a good outcome. I think your granddad would agree with that.
Yes, he will.
Yeah. Well, listen, you have a question?
I wanted to also talk about my friend Champ and the World War II veteran on my dad's side of the family, if that's fine.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, the World War II veteran on my dad's side of the family, he was a fighter pilot. He flew a Mustang, and he was also on D-Day. He helped in the air on D-Day.
Wow. They needed, by the way, they were heroes.
Yes.
There's one guy I want you to read about. For World War II is such a historic figure, and I'm obsessed with, is Winston Churchill. And ask your granddad to pull up maybe on YouTube when he gives his speech, you know, what is our plan? Victory. Victory. You know, I actually have audio tapes of Churchill. He talks like this. He goes, blood, tears, tile, and sweat. I can play a little for you. Winston Churchill. So there was a guy that was prime minister of England that met in Munich with Adolf Hitler and came back to and said, oh, in spite of Hitler's adventures and his territorial desires and his constant offense and unprovoked attacks and land grab, we're going to have peace in our time. And Winston Churchill knew better. And then when they needed Winston Churchill, he took the call and he became prime minister and he rallied the people of Great Britain to such an extent, even the bombing of Britain, he would go out amongst the people every day, which is kind of unheard of if you're a president or prime minister. But this is one of his more famous moments, and I want to play it for you.
I hope that any of my friends and colleagues or former colleagues who are affected by the political reconstruction will make all allowances for any lack of ceremony with which it has been necessary to act. I would say to the House, as I said to those who have joined the government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all our might, with all the strength that God can give us, to wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word. Victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be. But without victory, there is no survival. Let that be realized. No survival for the British Empire. No survival for all that the British Empire stood for. No survival for the urge and impulse of the ages that mankind will move forward towards its goal. But I take up my task with buoyancy and hope. I feel sure that our cause will not be suffered to fail among men. At this time, I feel entitled to claim the aid of all. And I say, come then, let us go forward together with our united strength.
I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. You're going to like reading about this guy. I think you're going to enjoy that. And the more you learn, you're going to see, you know, in the last century, 100 million human beings more, probably a lot more, were slaughtered by evil. So if you understand that at your young age, the last thing I can say to you before I have to go to a break here, Bryce, I could talk to you all day, is that you understand that lesson and you will always be a leader. And this world needs leaders. And those are my words of encouragement for you.
Thank you.
All right. And you said, and tell your granddad I said hello, and your family, and God bless you, and good luck in your future, whatever you decide to do. Architect, football player, lawyer, those are all pretty good choices. All right, my friend.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling. Pretty amazing kid, right?
I love that kid.
That kid is amazing.
I hope my son is that polite. I never heard an 11-year-old say sir so much in my life.
Well, you met my kids. They were pretty polite.
Yeah, but I mean, like, that they're, you know, grown-ups now.
Yeah, well, that's
MK
true.
Barely talked when I met her as a kid, and Patrick was playing the trumpet.
We used to call her the silent assassin. No, Patrick was not allowed to play the trumpet in the house because it went like this.
Oh, it wasn't that bad.
It was
poor
that
Patrick.
Bad. We still joke about it. He hated it, but they said he had to practice at home. I'm like, no, you don't. Forget it. Now, nobody wants it. That's what it sounded like. I'm like, oh my God, get rid of this instrument. I hate it.
For America.
All right, hour two, Sean Hannity Show on a Friday. Toll free on numbers 800-941-SEAN if you want to be a part of the program. We've got more problems. ISIS trying to cross the border. And some people, walls are immoral. Let's tear down all the walls, according to Robert Francis Beto Bozo. And we'll hit that at the bottom of this half hour. We'll have an update. But I want to draw your attention to a column, which is blockbuster when you get to the heart and soul of it, of John Solomon, investigative reporter and executive vice president of The Hill. Because if you recall last week, we had the 9.5-minute press conference, if you will, of Robert Mueller. And all of a sudden, the Mueller report never delivered what the left was telling us he was going to deliver. Now, that's the fourth time now that investigations have come to the same conclusion. And that is no Russia conspiracy, no Russia collusion of any type, no obstruction of justice. And it was a huge, massive letdown, exposed what we've been saying. It's nothing but fake news, conspiracy theories, frauds. The news media that has been so lazy and fixated on being an extension of all things extreme radical socialist Democrat, you know, literally caught with their hands in the cookie jar, running advance and advancing the lies, advancing the hoax, advancing the conspiracy theory. Anyway, so Mueller gives his 9.5-minute speech and he says, well, we couldn't indict the president because of Justice Department policy and the issue of whether a sitting president can or cannot be indicted. Leaving a clear implication, well, we might have. Well, I can't say it, but there's a possibility. Yet when you look at the fact that there was no underlying crime, the president was open in his criticisms of people like Rod Rosenstein at times, and he fired Comey. Comey deserved it. And he could have at any time have fired Robert Mueller himself under Article 2 legally. He had the legal authority to fire Mueller. And there were severe conflicts of interest. The day before Mueller became the special counsel, he was begging Donald Trump for the job as the FBI director. And then he got appointed by Rod Rosenstein. That was a surprise. They've had conflicts in the past at a golf club the president owned, I guess still owns, but as a private citizen. So he gives this 9.5-minute speech. It's like manna from heaven. Heavenly waters now have been sent to every liberal news media mob organization and Democrats on Capitol Hill. But it only lasts a couple of hours because there were multiple times, multiple witnesses that heard Robert Mueller say just the opposite. In other words, that was not a consideration for his decision. He was never going to make a decision on obstruction. He was going to present, as the law requires, what his findings are to the attorney general. This is not the old independent counsel statute. This is now the special counsel statute. And then it would be up to the attorney general to make a determination if any laws were broken. And in very short order, the attorney general Barr, the deputy attorney general Rod Rosenstein, and the Office of Legal Counsel concluded no obstruction. Mueller himself, no collusion. That was done quickly. The Mueller issue is dead. But he had to make a clarification. And frankly, my interpretation of it was that Attorney General Barr threw him a lifeline by allowing the special counsel's office to team with the attorney general and put out a statement that, this is what he really meant, a clarification, because he said the opposite. I got the feeling he didn't even read the draft. It seemed like it was written by somebody else. Anyway, now the next step. We're now discovering a lot of things in the so-called Mueller report are absolutely false. You know, it's literally breaking, and his key assertions in this document of his, 448 pages, are not accurate at all. You know, the report describes Paul Manafort's Ukrainian business partner as a shady individual with ties to Russian intelligence. In other words, the Mueller report wanted you to believe that the Trump campaign was essentially in bed with a Russian spy. But John Solomon breaks the story, and what do we find out? That we knew it was total BS, and Manafort's business partner was actually a sensitive intelligence source, but for the U.S. State Department. And how and why Team Mueller purposely deceived the people is beyond my imagination. It's probably likely one of the reasons Mueller doesn't dare want to go before Nadler's committee and face Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows. In fact, in this case, the guy had visited the U.S. twice in 2016 to meet with State Department officials. He regularly met with the chief political officer inside the U.S. embassy in Kiev, and Mueller had access to all that information, which means that this was a premeditated lie. And yet he cast a dark shadow on this individual and to present this person as a nefarious actor tied to Russia. It wasn't true. And the very same plan, by the way, that was given to the Trump campaign in 2016, a Ukrainian peace plan, well, that was presented to the Obama administration. Well, that context should have been in the Mueller report also, because Mueller's team knew it. So another example of outright deception. And just the latest in what is a pretty disturbing pattern. I mean, the deceptively edited transcript from the former Trump attorney, John Dowd, during a privileged routine call. Remember, in the case, they had a joint defense agreement with General Flynn, and Mueller conveniently leaves out John Dowd's statement that his request is for communication was, quote, not only for the president, but for the country, and that he was not asking for any confidential information, which was the exact opposite of what the Mueller team portrayed. And in other words, exculpatory evidence was ripped right out of it, which is classic Andrew Weissman, if you read License to Lie by Sidney Powell. And you can't forget all that and not come to a conclusion is that they purposely wrote this report, withholding knowledge, altering knowledge, just to make it look as bad as they could. John Solomon, who broke this story, is with us now. There's no way they didn't know what they were doing, John, because this was easily found out by them.
Well, listen, what I have is actually a section of the Mueller team's files. These are actually Robert Mueller's files. They include FBI interviews that the Robert Mueller team did with State Department officials who worked on a daily basis with this Manafort partner named Konstantin Klimenik. I have the cables and the emails in which State Department officials on a daily basis relayed valuable intelligence that came in from Mr. Klimenik to the ambassador at the Ukraine embassy in Kiev, to officials in Washington and among themselves. And I have all the emails that Mr. Klimenik sent to his handlers at the State Department. And he wasn't just dealing with any old person at the State Department. He dealt with the deputy chief of mission and the two chief political officers for the embassy. So he was such a valued asset that he was handled at the highest levels of the State Department. And one of the things things that are in the documents really clear. The State Department officials told the FBI they made a conscious effort never to put Mr. Klimenik's name in any cables for fear that WikiLeaks would get a hold of him and his identity as a secret source for the United States government would be compromised. So that was all sitting in Mueller's files. No doubt about it. Confirmed it by interviews, by the markings on the documents. Robert Mueller had that side of Konstantin Klimenik's life nailed down. And for reasons that I don't understand, and I have not been able to ascertain through reporting, Robert Mueller chose to portray Konstantin Klimenik as a Russian sympathist, somebody who had connections to the Russian intelligence group, the Russian intelligence services, without telling this entire other story. And I think that it disserves the public. If the goal of the Mueller report was to get transparency, the failure to mention this vast body of evidence that portrays Klimenik in a very different light, trusted by the United States government, giving valuable information.
But by the way, doesn't the same thing exist now? We know that Carter Page was an American asset, that he worked for the intelligence community. I asked him straight up and he said, well, it's out there. Yeah, I was working for our side.
Yeah, when that was in March of 16, as recently as March of 2016, just as he was joining the Trump campaign. It has now been verified by the FBI documents I obtained and others that Carter Page was working to help the FBI bring a case against Russian mobsters. So all of these missing elements always have a common pattern. The common pattern is they make the person close to Trump look dirtier, closer to Rush, more problematic than the actual evidence. And let me give you one example from the Konstantin Klimenik documents that just gives a sense of how misleading by omission the Mueller report is. The Mueller report makes a big deal out of the fact that Konstantin Klimenik, in August of 2016, came to New York. Now, that's a sign he's not a Russian spy, because if he's a Russian spy, we wouldn't have given him a visa. He gets in the country. He drops off a peace plan to try to settle the Russia-Ukraine crisis in Crimea. And the Mueller says, oh, my gosh, this is an example of him doing the Russians' bidding, and he was trying to influence Trump and get Trump involved in this matter. There's only one problem with that story. If you go through the FBI documents and the cables and the State Department memos that Bob Mueller possessed in his hands, Klimenik first delivered the peace plan to the Obama administration 4 months before he gave it to Trump. So he gave it to both parties. And how did the Obama administration react to it? State Department official thanked him, saying, this is very valuable information. We're noodling it over. If you have that part of the report, all of us, and you knew that part of Konstantin Klimenik, you'd go, well, why am I so worried about the contact with Donald Trump? It sounds like he was trying to get everybody aboard in solving the Ukraine crisis. All of that's omitted, and it's always omitted to the negativity of the Trump campaign. The portrayal of the negative of the Trump campaign is always more negative when there's an omission here. I think the American public have to ask why.
Well, I mean, you literally looked at hundreds of pages of government documents that we know that Robert Mueller possessed since 2018. And
that's right.
And they knew the demarcation. They knew the sensitive intelligence source that right. was this guy, Klimenik. And, you know, they know they were aware that he worked for the State Department and who informed on matters involving Ukrainian and Russia. And it was such an incomplete and deceptive portrayal of such an important person, and they used it in this overall narrative.
Right.
And to me, there's only one conclusion, is they wanted it to be interpreted the wrong way, and they purposely wrote it to be interpreted the wrong way. And I honestly think it just shows, and by the way, there's a poll out that confirms this, half of Americans now believe that Trump was a victim of a witch hunt. Yeah. And it also confirms my belief that Robert Mueller does not want to testify. And I don't think he will testify, because I don't think he can sustain the questioning of Jim Jordan, Mark Meadows and company.
Well, it'll be, I think Ken Starr said on your show last night, it would be a travesty for the American public if Mueller got away and didn't answer these very seminal questions that go to the credibility of his investigation, the credibility of his findings, and the honesty of the work that he said. And I remember something Ken said last night, Judge Starr said on your show. It was very important. He said when Bob Mueller made that 9-point statement, he emphasized that this investigation was built on the integrity of good people who worked with him. That integrity is now in question. That work is now in question. Why wouldn't Bob Mueller come and answer the questions that would allow us to assess
what went on? Well, he can't answer why he hired these people. He can't answer when he knew there was no collusion. He can't answer Why such a biased team? He can't answer questions like, why did you have time for taxi medallions and FARA violations, but not Hillary's dirty Russian dossier? All right, stay right there. John Solomon, investigative reporter, executive vice president for The Hill. He wrote another column with 10 questions for Hillary. We'll get to that as we continue. And yeah, ISIS down at the border, this is real, and we'll get an update on that situation also this hour as we continue. All right, as we continue, John Solomon. All right, so we've been going over these new developments. He broke it last night on Hannity, and the fact that there's so many, well, there's only one interpretation, that the Mueller report in many areas purposely twisted the information, having the knowledge, because John's article was basically the notes from the Mueller team. They had full knowledge what they were doing to make it look as bad as possible and purposely, deceptively, well, lying to the American people. There's no other way to really put it. And so now that that gets exposed, it's very telling. But I think there's going to be more that's coming out, as I understand, in the days and weeks ahead. So you, I know you, John, you have more, but I'm going to have to hold you through the break. Can you hang in there for a minute?
You betcha.
And the other thing is John wrote a column about Hillary Clinton and all the IOUs and all the answers to all the questions she should be asked by the corrupt media mob. But of course, they never have asked the tough questions on any of the issues involving her. If they do, then we're going to get back to the underlying crime of the Espionage Act. Then, of course, the intent of destroying the evidence, hence the subpoenaed emails deleted and bleach bit. And then we're going to probably have to ask questions about Uranium One and the $145 million kickback to the Clinton Foundation after, in fact, Putin's thugs were seeking and got the approval of the CFIUS board, of which she voted, and the people that kicked that money back were all involved in that deal. And of course, we're supposed to have some ongoing investigation that we really don't know about, but we'll get an update on that and the question she needs to answer most as we continue with John Solomon, investigative reporter, vice president for The Hill, on this Hannity edition on Friday. Glad you're with us.
The question for each of us to answer, especially you graduates, is will the symbol of this troubled age be the cynic's shrug, or will it be the raised hand of the volunteer, the activists' rolled up sleeves, the linked arms and marching feet of people who demand justice and democracy? The answer is up to all of us.
All right, 25 now till the top of the hour. Hillary, I mean, if you want to talk about one individual really out of touch, it would be her. We just told you in the last half hour about John Solomon, investigative reporter, executive vice president at The Hill, and, you know, all the inconsistencies that he found in the Mueller report that purposely were designed, because they had the information, to create a false narrative, false image, a deception, frankly, a lie about Donald Trump and about certain individuals to make it appear as something it's not, you know, posing as, you know, Russian asset when in fact they knew it was a State Department asset. These are big deals and they knew the truth, but they didn't print the truth. That is really troublesome and should be troublesome to every American. John has also written a column that I think needs a lot more attention than it's gotten. And it's called Hillary Clinton's Russia Collusion IOU and the Answer She Owes America. Now, the column ends with 10 very specific questions that Hillary Clinton does need to answer. But the pattern of political IOUs paid to the Clinton Foundation, it's not just the Uranium One deal where she sat on the board that made the decision, even though we had an FBI spy inside of Putin's network here in America, because Putin wanted a foothold in our uranium market. Uranium, of course, the base raw materials for nuclear weapons. We don't have enough uranium to make our own nuclear weapons. We even have to import uranium. And why we would ever sign off on giving 20% to a hostile regime and a hostile actor, again, Putin, is beyond anybody's comprehension. And just prior to that deal happening, Bill Clinton but got paid twice his normal speaking fee. He wanted to meet with nuclear regulators in Russia, but instead had an audience with Putin himself. And, you know, the bank that was involved in the Uranium One deal, well, they're the ones that were paying for Bill Clinton's speech. And she votes, even though we had William Campbell, FBI spy, undercover, Putin's network discovered in America, involved in bribery and kickbacks, money laundering, extortion. And still, Hillary was one of that board's nine people to approve the deal. And over time, $145 million made its way back to the Clinton Foundation. John, before we get to the questions, I mean, you know, you write every specific example here, and it's actually a frightening scenario and case that you're building that pay-to-play was at the highest level by the Clintons.
Yeah, listen, it's well documented. It's not even in doubt anymore. In fact, it wasn't even in doubt when she took over Secretary of State, because the State Department was so worried by the pattern of money flowing in from people who had business pending before her when she was a senator, they made her sign a special agreement like that no other Secretary of State had ever signed before, in which the Clinton Foundation would abstain from doing certain things and be transparent about where they got their money from. It turns out that they made those promises. They signed that letter. But as you know from earlier reporting I did, there were millions of dollars the Clinton Foundation hid from foreign contributors that were only found by, you know, things like when I found the Norwegian slush fund a few years back. So we know that the State Department even had this fear before she took over. The pattern is clear. It's never been fully investigated by an investigative body, and I think for some on the right, that is a frustrating thing. But I think the more important question now is, it has been 18 months since we first learned belatedly that Hillary Clinton funded the Christopher Steele dossier, the one that prompted the FBI to get the FISA. And she has not been asked a single question or answered a single question from a media member. She has not faced a single subpoena from a congressional committee. We're unaware of any grand jury subpoenas. And the point of my column was, it is time for her to answer these questions. When did she know that Christopher Steele was taking this political opposition research dirt and weaponizing it by going to the FBI? What did she know about Sidney Blumenthal and Cody Scherer talking to the State Department? What did she know about her lawyer going to James Baker and dumping more Trump dirt? Those are questions that she has escaped any scrutiny from. And I tried to put these questions out there in hopes that someone will soon one day ask her them.
Well, there's not going to be anybody in the media. You know, I tried That's in vain. Sure. You know, imagine if Donald Trump had ever started his political career in the home of unrepentant domestic terrorists, part of the Weather Underground, that were responsible and took responsibility for bombing the Pentagon, the Capitol, and New York City police headquarters. How many questions do you think Barack Obama was asked, having started his career in the home of Ayers and Dorgan? Just guess. How many do you think?
I would guess none.
Nope. There was one.
Wow.
One question. It came from George Stephanopoulos, and it came as a result of George being on this radio program the day before he was hosting debate. And when I said, I actually played it. I said, George, well, are you going to ask him about Ayers and Dorn? He goes, well, who are they? I said, George, do you read newspapers? They are the unrepentant terrorists. He started his career in their home. They live in that area of Chicago. And he goes, I didn't know that. And I said, 9/11, 2001, New York Times, Bill Ayers is quoted as saying, again, this is the day we're attacked, that early morning edition.
There are two questions that I don't think anybody has asked Barack Obama, and I don't know if this is going to be on your list tomorrow. One is the only time he's ever been asked about his association with Bill Ayers, the unrepentant terrorist from the Weather Underground, who on 9/11 of all days in the New York Times was saying, I don't regret setting bombs. I don't think we did enough. When asked about it by the Politico, David Axelrod said they have a friendly relationship and that they had done a number of speeches together and that they sat on a board together. Is that a question you might ask?
Well, I'm taking notes right now.
September 11, 2001, of all days, there was an article in the New York Times, and there are a number of quotes about Bill Ayers, and the Politico had in there the comments about from David Axelrod. I think that's an interesting question that nobody in the media has really brought up. We've highlighted a little bit more here on this program, but let me see if I can help you. You want any more questions?
Yeah, keep going.
The Chicago Reader talked about and commented, has
all
comments
right, that's
of
enough
Barack
for
Obama.
That. But he asked the question to his credit, but the fact that he didn't know and the flimsy answer was, well, he's just a guy in the neighborhood, George, and nobody ever asked again. And their relationship was, we found out later, far more extensive than anybody ever knew.
Yeah, well, you know, I think, as I've said many times, curiosity in my profession in the media has really waned. You don't see reporters read up as well. You don't see them asking the tough questions, and you don't see them following up or sticking with the story long enough to get to the truth, with the exception of the Russia case, where we did the opposite. The media spent a long time telling a story that ended up not being true at all. But I think in general, that curiosity that gave us reporters like Woodward and Bernstein and important Pulitzer Prize projects in the 80s and the 90s, it seems to be waning. There seems to be an acceptance of talking points, and people seem to be more focused on whether someone's been called nasty in an interview who's just a pop culture figure, rather than really focusing on the meritorious policy issues and political ethics issues that dominate Washington. And I think it's a real problem for the industry. I'm still committed to doing it. There's a small group of us every day I see around town that still want to do it the old-fashioned way. But there's a gap in the journalism profession. There's a failure, and it's been about 10, 12 years in the making now of asking hard questions and really, in a bipartisan, neutral way, getting to the truth of difficult stories like political ethics.
How do you explain that the 99.9% of media in this country is basically an extension of all things Democratic Party? They never vetted Obama. They never gave out his 8-year record. And when you give it out, it's atrocious. They, in this particular case, they went along with and disseminated night after night lies, misinformation, propaganda. They had hysteria and glee in their voice on the nights that they thought that they got the president once and for all. It turns out none of it was true. Well, people like you and Greg and Sarah and Joe and Victoria, I can't name everybody. All these people that I call the ensemble cast have put together a story of unprecedented abuse of power and corruption, a rigged presidential candidate investigation. Then we had a rigged primary. Nobody cared about Bernie. They tried to rig a presidential election. They spied on an opposition party campaign based on Russian lies that one party paid for by purposely misleading and willfully misleading and committing a fraud on FISA courts. And they used it to bludgeon then candidate Trump, then Trump transition team Trump, and then Trump the president. And all of it happened, and nobody paid attention to any of it, except for a few of us.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I do see signs now that people are looking back and finding some of the stories they missed. It's a slow process. I think before it's all done, particularly because of Bill Barr, the entire media will ultimately cover the final findings, and that'll be good for the country. But, you know, I've always said this, and when I guest teach at journalism schools, you are a function of the people you talk to. And if you only talk to one party, if you only talk to one type of source, even in the intelligence community, if you only talk to the CIA and you don't talk to the FBI, you're in danger of getting hijacked by one person's perspectives. And the greatest weapon journalists have to stay in the center, to be neutral, is to talk to as many people as possible. Today, reporters are more concerned about their next tweet and their next television appearance, and they're not really having that bipartisan communication that can give you a complete story. And I think that's one of the great tragedies in our industry. We've become a hostage to small groups of sources we hang out with, and we're not surveying the entire sky and trying to get to the truth.
Well, let me ask you this, because the swamp, the sewer that is Washington, D.C., it's a very incestuous culture. I mean,
sure.
You have people in congressional offices, Senate offices, right. Lobbyists, then you have staffers of the lobbying groups, and they all go to dinner together, and
that's right.
A lot of them date each other, and, you know, they're just all friendly with each other, and it's like they all believed a big lie, and it wasn't hard to figure out. Now, I know you did a lot of digging, and you made a lot of phone calls, and I did the same, and everybody else that was part of this group did the same. Our desire was to get to the truth, but fairly early on, we knew that this was not true.
No, there's no doubt.
And yet it became the narrative, and frankly, they came much closer than I feel comfortable with ever knowing, really, really damaging and destroying a duly elected president.
Yeah. You know, my dad was a law enforcement officer for 46 years, eventually became police chief, but he ran the Detective Bureau in Connecticut for a long, long time. And he had two rules, and I've tried to adapt them to journalism. I think they're really great. Never become hostage to your witnesses. Or in our case, never become hostage to your sources. Always try to keep independence from them. Don't get too close, because the danger is you'll miss something when that closeness. And then I think the second thing he used to always say is follow the evidence, don't define the evidence, meaning don't come to a theory and then look at the evidence, because you can always manipulate the evidence to come to your theory. Follow the evidence until you get to the truth. And he had that his whole life, and he was such a great detective. He broke some of the biggest murder cases in American history, and it was because he kept that neutrality and independence. I think a lot of what he practiced in his career could really be practiced in journalism a lot better. It's certainly been at my thing. I'm always curious, but I never let people try to tell me what to write. I try to follow the facts, and then after I have the facts, write it. Too much today is that we see reporters telling a story.
Do you get criticized for it? Do people look down on you? Do you get attacked? I mean, there were friends of mine that come on your show and they go, yeah, we pay a price being friends with you, Hannity.
Yeah, listen, absolutely. There's been a lot of controversy about the amount of time I've spent on your shows. There's a lot of controversy about the early on when I took on these stories and I was rowing against the tide of the rest of journalism. The good thing about that is I really don't care about all that feedback. I care about getting to the truth. And, you know, people can look back at my career. There was a period of time where I had the same sort of treatment. It was right after 9/11 when I reported a lot of the stories of what the FBI and the Bush administration knew before 9/11. And, of course, that was an unpopular story. Everyone in the media was, we were sucker punched. Well, no, the FBI missed a big opportunity.
Hey, listen. The 9/11 commission report nailed it. They were at war with us. We were not at war with them.
That's right.
Kenya, Tanzania, the first Cole. Trade Center bombing, the USS Cole. I'm sorry. They were telling us they're at war, and we didn't listen. We did not listen. All right, John Solomon, great job on this. Let's keep getting to the truth and exposing those that abuse power and are corrupt. And we will see you again. I know you're working on a big story for next week as well. See you then.
Sounds good, Sean. Have a great weekend.
All right, quick break. When we come back, shockingly, there are captured ISIS fighters at the southern border and a terror group planning to use the Mexican border to attack the U.S. Are we going to listen to that warning?
Next, our final news roundup and information overload hour.
The big scam of the whole address was that there's a crisis. There's not a crisis.
Folks, the president has manufactured one heck of a political crisis for himself.
Donald Trump is manufacturing a national security crisis.
You will hear them say is that this is a manufactured crisis. It's not a national security crisis.
It remains a Seinfeld shutdown. All about nothing.
What happens when there is a real crisis? When there is a real emergency? Does he take to the airwaves? Do we give him the airwaves? Do we believe him?
Some question if there is a crisis at all, as the president has claimed.
There is not a crisis at the border. It's a manufactured crisis for the president to get a political win.
Crisis can have, as we see now, a very elastic definition.
He's determined to convince you there is a crisis at the border, even though an intelligence official tells CNN, quote, no one is saying this is a crisis except them.
All right, news roundup, information overload hour. And this is not news I ever want to bring the American people, but we have now captured an ISIS fighter. He's made a chilling confession to U.S. interrogators that spotlights yet again in a different form and fashion. We already know 90% of the heroin that enters this country is from our southern border. Fentanyl now is a huge problem. We know we're losing 300 Americans a week because of this insidious drug problem we have. We should stop it for the sake of the children of this country. Then, of course, the human trafficking. We've interviewed many people that have chronicled for years young girls, young teenage girls that are literally trafficked into, you know, sex slavery, you know, where they're being raped 30 plus times a day. We've chronicled 2 year periods where we've had nearly, what, over 4,000 homicides by illegal immigrants in this country, 30,000 sexual assaults, 100,000 violent assaults in 2 years. And yet we have people tell us that walls are immoral now because they weren't immoral in Barack Obama's second term, but only because Trump is supporting it. And other people saying we ought to tear down the walls and have no borders at all. And then Democrats passing the biggest amnesty ever in the history of the country. It's not going anywhere, but that's where their mindset is. And yet all we're saying is, yeah, we've got to protect our borders. We got to stop human trafficking, drug trafficking, the cartels, the gangs, find those people, yeah, that might have links or ties to terror. We need to vet people. People need to be able to take care of themselves. They can't rely on the American taxpayer if they get the opportunity to come into the country. And yet that's a big problem for all the 2020 Democratic candidates. Well, now we have an ISIS fighter, Canadian citizen, dual citizenship in Trinidad, a Canadian citizen with dual citizenship, last month saying he was sought out by ISIS and their leadership to attack the U.S. from a route starting in Central America, and allegedly traveled to Syria with the intention of serving as an ISIS fighter. But he was later told he could not take on soldier duties due to chronic illness. And at the end of 2016, he claimed to have been invited by the ISIS intelligence wing to join other people from Trinidad and launch official financial and other attacks on the U.S., described as to cripple the U.S. economy, and said to have been informed that he would be issued false identification, false passports. He would be maneuvered from Puerto Rico to Mexico and then into the United States. Apparently somebody conspired with him from New Jersey, and I was going to take a boat from Puerto Rico into Mexico, and he was going to smuggle me in, according to this ISIS collaborator, and elaborated that he believed the scheme was aimed at New York financial targets. They wanted to use these people to attack inside the U.S., because they were from these areas. Anyway, joining us now is Mark Morgan, acting director of ICE. First, congratulations on your position. And you've been on the program with us before. I have always had a fear of this. We know that there are people that are part of nefarious groups and terror groups that try to infiltrate these migrant caravans. And even use children as a means of entering the United States, even kids they don't even know.
Yeah, Sean. So you're absolutely right. And the latest, with respect to the ISIS fighter, it'll be very interesting as that investigation unfolds and we actually see the truth behind what happened. But Sean, you hit the nail on the head. It's just one more piece of factual-based information and intelligence that should be alarming the American people. I mean, you hit it, Sean. I mean, the drug trafficking, the human trafficking, the gangs, the child smuggling, sexual exploitation, and now this. I mean, I keep asking, when is enough going to be enough before people say, yeah, this is a real crisis that we have to address? It's just frustrating.
Well, it's frustrating, but we know the implications here. And I think one of the reasons we're seeing this massive rush at the southern border and why it's become a big crisis is because, well, we now have a big court decision. The president is free to allocate the funds from the Defense Department on top of the other $1.35 billion, on top of the wall that he's already built, about 115 new miles of wall, on top of all the wall areas that he had to repair as well that were in disrepair. And so I think the rest of the world kind of understands that door is going to close and close pretty quickly. So they're getting in while the getting's good.
Well, I think there's some truth to that, Sean. But, there's still a good chunk of the southwest border that has no infrastructure, no technology and personnel. And so I'm still concerned about those areas as well. And so in the meantime, while that infrastructure and the personnel technology are built up, we still have an extreme incentive. And that is, you grab a kid because of our broken laws that we have talked about. You and I have talked about this many, many times. But because of the floor settlement agreement, because of TVPRA, and Congress won't do what they will not do their job that they know that they could fix. Because of that, they know you grab a kid, you're going to be – it's a passport. A child now is a passport into this country. You're going to be allowed to come in and then stay forever. And that's why just recently, since I've taken over the job, I've said, look, one of the biggest incentives is the fact once they get here, they stay. And so we have to do interior enforcement operations. Anyone that is here that is in violation of the federal immigration law – And you've got to, or especially if you've got to order a deportation or removal, no one should be exempt from that.
What does the law allow? Why is it possible that once people pretty much cross the border, they're allowed to stay? They're given court dates, but 98% of them never show up. And then when they're captured, depending where they're captured and maybe even involved in another crime.
Mexico tariffs, big news back home. Some Senate Republicans are a little worried about this, especially economic effects. What must Mexico do? What can they do to stem this massive tide, 140,000 people in May?
When you're the piggy bank that everybody steals and robs from and they deceive you and they've like they've been doing for 25 years, tariffs are a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful word if you know how to use them properly. Republicans should love what I'm doing because I view tariffs in two phases. Number one, it's great to negotiate with because people don't want to be tariffed for coming into the United States. They don't want that. And number two, frankly, if they go on, you make a fortune because all the companies are going to move back into the country.
But isn't this Congress's fault for not passing asylum reform? So why does it seem like Mexico's bearing the brunt?
Well, because it's their fault also because they're letting millions of people walk up through their country and they shouldn't let anybody walk up through their country. I mean, frankly, we shouldn't even have to have Border Patrol. Border Patrol's doing incredibly. You know, they apprehended over 100,000 people last. You know what that is?
140,000 in May.
Well, and what they're doing is they're taking, it's. And by the way, that's not even close to a record because if you go back 13, 14 years ago, it was crazy numbers. But I don't want this. I want people to come in legally. We want the people that we want, and I want a merit-based system. But we shouldn't have anybody. They shouldn't be able to walk through Mexico. And now I've told Mexico, if you don't stop this onslaught, this invasion, people get angry when I use the word invasion. People like Nancy Pelosi, that honestly, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. I watch her. She was saying, we have to protect Mexico. We have to take care of Mexico. Look, I'm dealing with Mexico right now. They send in $500 billion worth of drugs. They kill 100,000 people. They ruin a million families every year. If you look at that, that's really an invasion without the guns.
Well, then they have sanctuary city or state status in California, the whole state, where they're not handed over to Border Patrol agents and sent back from where they came. What every other country does this. As a matter of fact, Mexico had some of the harshest treatment of illegal immigrants from Central America, where they'd either put them in jail or send them right home. In Australia, you try to get into Australia, they're going to meet you wherever the point of entry is. They're going to turn you back the way you came. They'll give you food, water, and medical treatment, but you're out immediately. No questions asked.
That's right, Sean. You explained it, why it's so difficult to do interior enforcement operations. And then I'll add to that, on the families, there's an issue with the political will. And so we need to address that. As a law enforcement officer, you're either here illegally in violation of federal immigration law, and no one should be exempt. There's no demographic that should be exempt. That's the starting point. And then with respect to the humanitarian crisis, again, one of the greatest incentives they know. So 98% of the family units that arrived here in 2017 are still here. This year alone, ICE has actually released into the United States 200,000 family members, and that's not even including how many Border Patrol has. If we don't apply consequences and the rule of law and start removing the individuals, including families, that have gone through our due process and received orders of removal, they're going to keep coming, Sean. They're not going to stop.
Well, it's obvious they're not going to stop. Now, the president can't do all of this alone. Now, by reallocating funds and the emergency order that they weren't able to override his veto in Congress, now a court has upheld it. We have legislatively, the president has the right to build borders, especially in drug trafficking corridors. That would be the entire southern border.
Most heavily traded monetarily border anywhere in the world, and it's not even close. To make certain that we are constantly making the upgrades we need, our proposal creates a permanent and self-sustaining border security trust fund. This will be financed by the fees and revenues generated at the border crossings itself. Importantly, we're already building the wall, and we should have close to 400 miles built by the end of next year.
So he has powers legislatively. And when you look at the violent crime statistics that I mentioned earlier in a two-year period, homicides, violent sexual assaults, violent assaults in general, to me, as the commander-in-chief, he would have the constitutional authority to do what is necessary to protect the country. But again, you know, what does the law state? Why do we have a system that allows people to stay here only because Democrats are pretty much guaranteed to give them amnesty down the road because that's what they've always wanted and seem to always want. And yet now they're telling us walls are immoral and the walls up should be taken down.
And Sean, what I would add to that, too, is that there's a budget issue to this. So Congress knows full well that for us to effectively do our job, both Border Patrol and ICE, we need beds. We need detention space. And so I'll give you an example. Right now, Border Patrol, their capacity is 4,000. They have 19,000 in their detention facilities. ICE, we were funded for about 45,000. We have 52,000. So and they know that. And so we're asking for the 4.5 supplemental. HHS, they're slammed too, that handle the kids. So this is a crisis, and yet we need funding from Congress, not only to pass the laws, but we need additional funding to be able to do our job, and they're not doing it. And so, you know, it's not just about protecting American citizens, Sean, and I know you talked about this, but right now, child smuggling. Right now, we have individuals that are renting kids. They're renting kids because, again, the kid is the passport. They get into the country, then they're dropping off the child to a facilitator in the United States who is then flying them back to Mexico to be recycled again as a fake family. It's
unbelievable.
Disgusting. Unbelievable.
And where are their parents in all of this? You know, how are they doing it for money? Why would they do that? Why would they ever let that happen?
All good questions.
Unbelievable. All right. Congrats on the new job. Mark Morgan, Acting Director of ICE, thanks for being with us. A lot of work to do down there. We better do it expeditiously. You know, you just listen to the Democrats, though. Just listen to them in their own words on this. And the hypocrisy is just reeks of just pure partisanship.
The big scam of the whole address was that there's a crisis. There's not a crisis.
Folks, the president has manufactured one heck of a political crisis for himself.
Donald Trump is manufacturing a national security crisis.
You will hear them say is that this is a manufactured crisis. It's not a national security crisis.
It remains a Seinfeld shutdown.
Seinfeld presidency.
All about nothing.
What happens when there is a real crisis? When there is a real emergency? Does he take to the airwaves? Do we give him the airwaves? Do we believe him?
Some question if there is a crisis at all, as the president has claimed.
There is not a crisis at the border. It's a manufactured crisis for the president to get a political win.
Crisis can have, as we see now, a very elastic definition.
He's determined to convince you there is a crisis at the border, even though an intelligence official tells CNN, quote, no one is saying this is a crisis except them.
All right, 25 till the top of the hour. All right, we made it. I don't know what it is. These weeks go fast. They fly by. They're so intense because there's so much at stake for the country. That's how I feel. And, I had a great time. I want to say thank you to Michael Harrison today and all my friends at Talkers. Talkers is the industry publication for talk radio. And, all of the people that I know in this industry, there's even some that hate me. For whatever reason, I have no idea, but that's their problem, not mine. But, you know, thank God for talk radio. Thank God that we have this alternative voice. And I don't know what the country would be like. I mean, when Rush first came on the scene in 1988, what would those intervening years be without that booming conservative voice of reason? You know, and the path that he forged for so many others, me included, Mark included, I just don't know what it'd be like. And obviously Fox, I think we can safely say that talk radio showed there was a market for people that are tired of liberal lying and propaganda and misinformation. Anyway, I just had a great time, got to see so many of my friends, and it was just a great honor to be there as I try to be every year. I think I've only missed two. Last year I missed because we were in Vietnam, right?
Oh, we were in Singapore.
Where were we again?
In Singapore.
Singapore? Say it again.
We were in Singapore.
Singapore.
Enough. You keep it moving.
It's Singapore.
Whatever.
You know, I've just read this book, and I am actually amazed at people that can do something that is really hard to do. Like, when I talk about religion and you talk about your faith, you know, I don't talk about it in terms of, I was raised Catholic, but I really consider myself a Christian. And I've gotten to know the Robertson family. And remember, this show is such a massive hit that they have, Duck Dynasty. And at the end of every episode, they would pray. And the America took to it. They loved it because that is a big part of this country. This country was founded on Judeo-Christian principles, or biblical principles, if you will, Old New Testament. And it's amazing how good the American people are. We remembered the brave Americans in this nation joining the fight, and the world needed us, and all the blood and sacrifice of others. Amazing. You know, the good book says there's no greater love hath a man than to lay down his life for another. Think of those guys slamming the beaches, Omaha Beach and the beaches of Normandy, you know, and how many knew they were going to their death, but they did it anyway. And the whole story of Christ, you know, on a cross, the one perfect human being, and that was his purpose, and he knew it was coming, and humiliated and spit at and beaten to near death and murdered on a cross for the purpose of reconciling man to God, the creator. And I don't know how anyone can be an atheist if, putting all religion aside for a second, how can you look at the majesty of creation and see universes within universes within universes within universes, and the sun and the stars and the planets and the moon and the sky and, you know, all of the world of nature before us, and the magnitude and specificity in the of a lion, a leopard, a giraffe, a rhinoceros, an elephant, a dog, a cat, and, you know, through human beings, which are imperfect, obviously, you know, down to the littlest, you know, insects you barely discern. Pretty amazing. Well, just gravity alone. How people believe that there was a big bang, and my question, well, where did the bang come from? Where did the energy for the bang come from if you don't believe there's a greater being? Anyway, but it goes further, because in that moment, Jesus said, forgive them, for they know not what they do, for people that kill them. And I don't think I'm the greatest forgiver in life, I'll be honest. I people can get off my list pretty quick, and I think Linda's worse than me. You get on her hate list, God help you. You know, she's going to keep that high heel on your neck for a long time, from what I can see. But there's a new book by Al and Lisa Robertson. It's called Desperate Forgiveness, and it was just released, and it's about this topic. And they tell stories about the Columbine victim's daughter was in the news because she's now friends with and meets regularly with the mother of one of the school shooters, or Steve Scalise, House Republican minority leader, making headlines discussing his road to forgiveness when he was shot on that bald field, and so many other examples. Anyway, Al and Lisa of Duck Dynasty fame are with us. How are you guys?
Hey, we're doing great, Sean.
And by the way, and I forgive the patriarch Phil Robinson for wanting to baptize me in a swamp full of alligators. I said no.
He wants to make it as difficult as possible, no doubt. But see, you're already in the spirit of desperate forgiveness because you got it. And by the way, we gave a book to Linda as well. And see, I didn't know what you just said.
Oh no, Linda has a hate list. Linda, you gotta come straight here. You need to tell them what happens if you get off the list. If you get on that list, you're dead.
I mean, it's a very, it's a short list. It's under 20 people.
Short list under 20 people that
listen,
you won't forgive.
I love Al and Lisa, what? And I told them when they were here, I was like, you guys are awesome. First of all, Lisa awesome. Is like gorgeous. She doesn't look like she could be old enough to have written a book with this much information and knowledge. So bless your heart. And, you know, they are just the most lovely people. And I said, are you writing a book on what? Forgiveness. I'm like, God bless you. Because I just, you know, my whole thing is, I forgive you, but I also won't ever want to talk to you again. I just never do.
By the way, is that a fair thing if you can forgive somebody but you don't want anything to do with them?
Well, look, we say in the book, Sean, that you can forgive people that you don't necessarily continue a relationship with. It happens all the time. An ex-spouse or someone else that it doesn't make sense to have a continued relationship. But when you can extend forgiveness in your own heart, then you release them continuing to hurt you and cause bitterness. That's the key for you. Forgiveness is as much for us as it is for some other person.
So you could, like, just forgive somebody, but you know what? But we're done. Lisa, does that make sense, or?
Well, sure it does. If they hurt you bad enough, I mean, it's that way with a family member that molested me as a child. I've forgiven him, but I have nothing to do with him. And on this side of heaven, that relationship's not going to be restored. But, you know, hopefully one day in heaven, that relationship will be as a family member should be.
What you're really saying to me and what I'm hearing is that if you hate somebody and you hold on to it, you're really hurting yourself as much, if not more, than the other person.
Exactly. It's the way that bitterness works. The Bible says that a bitter root sets up.
Hang on one second. Linda, you need to pay very close attention at this point.
I'm listening.
Okay. You look distracted for a second.
Never.
When a bitter root sets up in your heart, it causes trouble and defiles many. And that defilement starts with you because it's insipid. It goes in every part of your life. And it can really ruin people. I mean, you have people that can't get past things. You know, and like Lisa described, we talk about in the book, she was molested. Obviously, that had a huge impact not only on her, but also our family, our marriage. And yet, finally, when she was able to release that to God, we still don't want to be around this man. I don't want my kids or grandkids around him. But at the same time, now he holds no more sway over her or us. And that's the key to what forgiveness does.
You know, I think I hear you, and I think I understand it completely. And don't people that you forgive, don't they have to really want to change? Don't they have to want to make the move? Like, for example, say, all right, I can forgive you, but you need to do A, B, and C for yourself or for us to have a relationship in any way. You know, I don't know, either a personal relationship or whatever.
Well, sure, if you're going to have a relationship with them, then, you know, change has to occur. But, you know, if you choose to not have that relationship with them, then they can do whatever they want to. If they decide to not ever change, they don't ever have to. But it's what it does within you. It releases you as being a victim. So you're no longer a victim, you know, of their hate and what they have done to you.
What about people when they ask forgiveness? They go, well, if I hurt you in any way, I'm sorry. That doesn't sound
really
like an apology to me.
That's not an apology. No, it's not. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, you have to say, you know what, I'm sorry, like Linda had to tell me the other day that she was sorry she shushed me in the middle of a conversation.
Oh, really? I think you flipped the script on that one, my brother. I'm pretty sure like that was the other way around.
As if shushing somebody is worthy of an apology. I mean,
so Al and Lisa, what actually happened was he shushed me in a meeting with people we were meeting for the first time.
Because she was distracting from the entire meeting. I said, you shush, let me finish. He was interrupting me. That was rude.
And you know what? I forgave him.
That's very good of you, Linda.
Thank you, my friend.
It just occurred to me that, Linda, you're like Sean's work wife.
Indeed, I am.
Great. Yeah,
I get it. I get it now.
No, okay, great. No, she thinks that the name of the show is the Linda McLaughlin Show. Sometimes.
I do not. Come on.
And she thinks we can't survive a day without her, and we do fine without her.
First of all, you do not do fine without
me.
You do better with me. You do all right without me.
Well, you always do better with you, but you can go away and stop being neurotic and calling and obsessing.
So, Al and Lisa, where can we find out more about your book, and where can folks get it?
You can get it on all the typical book sources, Amazon.com.
We'll put it up on Hannity.com, bookstores everywhere. All right, last question. Why does Phil, now I've watched Duck Dynasty, the swamp outside of his trailer, and it is a trailer, and he needs a new chair, it's disgusting, the swamp has real alligators in it. Why would he ever, and I read a story about a pastor that died and was killed and eaten by an alligator. Why would he ever want to take me out in that swamp and baptize me there?
Well, he hasn't said for sure, but it may be, Sean, he's thinking you've got enough stuff going on in the past that he wants you to have the full count of the cost before you make that move. And so a dangerous path might be the best way for you. You know, you are pretty much in the crosshairs of a lot of people. So you're a dangerous man. I don't think those alligators would stand a chance with Sean Hannity. I'm going to say you're there.
I ain't going in there without a number of guns in my hand that are going to work underwater. All right, guys. Al, Lisa, it was great to see you when you all were up in town, and I hope Linda paid very close attention to today's Bible lesson.
I did indeed, and I will buy their book.
And by the way, the book is called
You Too, Al.
Forgiveness, Hannity.com, Amazon.com, bookstores everywhere. Thanks for being with us. All right, that's going to wrap things up for today, but let not your heart be troubled, as we will be back on Monday, and every day we're that much closer to the IG report. I'm beginning to hear rumblings that it's done, beginning to hear that it may even be in the Attorney General's hands, maybe even part of a broader investigation, but what do I know? I'm just a little talk show host. God bless you all. Have a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday, and we'll see you then.